Good evening, James McCanny here with My Science Hour, June 18, 2020, and many topics to cover tonight. I will not be talking about political issues. I'm going to have a lot of science issues to cover, and I'm going to get back to dealing strictly with science. There's certainly enough reporting on all these other topics. I had some very important things to contribute over past months, and so it was necessary to divert my attention. Just first of all, a very good interview by David Icke. I think this just came out a couple days ago. It was where I saw it was on somebody else's webpage. It's called Most People Don't Realize It's Happening 2020. And it was about artificial intelligence and the addictive nature of what's going on with the high-tech companies, the Googles, the Facebooks, the Wikipedias, on and on. But the part that caught my attention was something I've been talking about for a very long time, and that is fragmented attention or lack of attention span. When I was on the Coast to Coast show, it was May 26. You may wish to go and listen to that if you missed that show. A very good interview where I covered a number of topics. But in the interview, George asked me about my study and, you know, the history of my studying. And I talked about being in high school. And it was in the wintertime. And so I had very long periods of concentration, hours and hours, where I trained my mind to be comfortable with being by myself. Something I did also was I went out into the wilderness as a youth and went out sometimes just walking in the countryside. I grew up in a small town, so you could literally walk to the edge of town and then keep going and then come back at the end of the day. So, or go out into the wilderness, into the northern wilderness, and this required one to be very secure in yourself. And at first, when I started doing that, it was kind of like tenuous. It was like, geez, I'm all by myself, you know, and I don't have all my security things around me. And but I got used to that, and it's something you really should get used to. But the bottom line is, all of this required a lot of concentration. And there was no cell phone, there was no, instant communication or anything. You know, there were, none of that existed back then. But then also when I studied, when I was in high school, I had this big desk. My dad got me this huge desk, and it had all of these portals up above where I could keep my different filings of my information, etc., and a great big surface. And so anyway, when I studied physics and science in high school, mathematics, I would have this very organized. But the point is, in the middle of winter in Minnesota, if you've ever been to a place like that, there's long periods of just absolute silence. And some people might go a little stir crazy like that. Well, I used it to train my mind to spend long periods of time thinking. And the same when I was in college. I had an office in the physics department. All of the physics majors did where I went. Private school, very, nine physics majors in the whole school. And so it was very intensive. It was very intensive. When I taught at Cornell, there was nothing like what I did at Cornell. Believe me, I got a much better education than the kids paying whatever when I was there in 79. It's like $65,000 a year just for tuition. But anyway, I had long periods of time to concentrate on my work, uninterrupted, and so that was very important. I mean, in college, I had a double major, physics and mathematics, so that was very difficult, and it took a lot of time, believe me. You had, especially junior, senior year, you had high-level classes and in both physics and mathematics filling up most of my schedule because all my requirements were done, you know, maybe my sophomore year. And so, but the point is long periods of concentration. But now what they want to do is divide up your attention in like 5 or second sound bites, like Twitter or something like that. The idea is that it's got to be very short. So, boom, okay, you get a little information. And in this information age, kids and parents don't have the ability to concentrate. I notice sometimes if I start talking to some people and, you know, they have no attention span. It's like 2 or 3 seconds and they're wandering off. You can see them wandering off mentally. They can't handle more than a half a minute conversation because their brain can't concentrate, can't lock on a subject. And that's what's happening to kids. And so what happens is, for example, to understand logical reasoning, you need to have long periods of time where you can put together reasoning patterns. Well, kids don't have that anymore. They're not taught logic or reason or, putting things together and thinking. On a test, typically it's memory. It's just root memory and the remembering a topic. If you write it down, oh, then you got an A and you think you're smart. But no logic, no thinking, no thought process. So at any rate, this is what's happening with kids today. And it's really, very difficult to teach kids science when they can't concentrate. So anyway, I'll just refer you once again. This is David Icke's monologue here. He's being interviewed, actually. In the name of it, once again, it's Most People Don't Realize It's Happening 2020. So I'd suggest you go check that out. And it also talks about artificial intelligence, how they're trying to move. And I've seen this, I talked about this last week, about them trying to do everything possible to change your DNA. Remember I quoted a space.com article saying that you have to change your DNA before you go to Mars. Excuse me, it doesn't have anything to do with it. But somebody's going to try and convince you. And then with people, if they don't have logic, they go, oh, geez, I got to change my DNA before I can go to Mars because somebody said it. You know, there's got to be some critical thinking. And we're, you know, I think we've lost a whole generation or two here, and it's got to come back. And for that reason, it's very good. From my perspective, it's very good that the schools are closed. This gives parents a chance to step back and say, how am I going to educate my kids? Because you don't want them in those schools, believe me. It's a trap. It's something like, and if I were a parent, I'd go to the city council and say, hey, schools are closed. My kid ain't going there. I'm not paying the taxes. 50% of your taxes go to that stupid school. Excuse me. Not a good deal. There was a photo from the European Space Agency. It came out of EOS. This is a newsletter I get from the American Geophysical Union. And there was an asteroid that the Japanese landed on this asteroid and took pictures. And it looks like kind of like your backyard strewn full of rocks if you lived out in the desert. But anyway, the space debris, and of course they're going to analyze this junk, this stuff on the surface of an asteroid, and then they're going to claim, oh, that's what this asteroid is made of. So I've made this statement before, and I don't know why these people can't figure this out. If you look at the Earth, if you look at our moon, if you look at Mars, if you look at any planet in the solar system, what's on the surface has nothing, I repeat, nothing to do with what is inside of the object. The debris on the surface is simply stuff that collected there over the eons and eons that this thing has been floating around in outer space. And even a small asteroid has enough gravitational pull that when a fairly good-sized rock comes along, it will hold it in place. You know, if it kind of bumped into it, it'll hold it. And there are other things that cause that to happen also. But basically, you know, this is what's on the surface. It's just a conglomeration of collection over, you know, millions of years. So anyway, a continuation of bad science there. The NASA had its super secret X-35 mini shuttle I saw a movie of it, and they were touting this thing, how it's like super secret, and they had some kind of distant photos of this. This is an exact copy of the Russian Cosmos mini shuttle, which was being flown in the 1969 era. Thousands and thousands of flights with this, because the Russians, when they had their in the height of their space program in the 1960s, they had so much lift capability with the rockets that they could put this little Cosmos mini shuttle right on the nose and get it up there basically for free. Their payloads really were too small for the size. Their rockets were too big, let's just put it that way. So they had this extra lift capability to get into low Earth orbit. So these mini Cosmos shuttles were operational for about a decade, and they had thousands of flights. It would hold three people. There's a picture of it on my webpage, not the main webpage, but if you tunnel down into my webpage a little bit, you will see a picture of the Cosmos, and it has all the tables from the RAND Corporation, which was one of the kind of the intelligent briefing organizations back in the day, with all of the flights. So the United States knew all about this. They kept it from the public, making the public think that the United States space program was the epitome, the cutting edge, the winner, always first, always beating Russia. Now, I'm afraid that was wrong, still wrong. And so anyway, just clarifying that the NASA super secret X-35 mini shuttle, there's nothing new under the sun there. Here's my notes are a little bit out of order here, but I'm going to start on this topic. The idea that I talk about the universe is infinite in size and extent, and there's, as far as we're concerned, it is infinite. For example, say you had a number line. You know what a number line is? It's just a line on a piece of paper, and it goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and it keeps going out to infinity. And say you were an ant that was walking along the number line, and you started to walk, and you said, "I'm going to walk to infinity." And then after you walked for a while, you'd say, "Well, you know, I probably can't walk to infinity, but I wonder if I can just see to infinity." So then you'd build a telescope. And, what you try and do is see if you could see the number line way out in the numbers that went way out to infinity. And then you'd realize, well, you know, with the telescope you built, you could only see a certain distance out towards infinity. So then you'd go, well, I want to build a bigger telescope. If I only built one 10 times bigger, then I could really see out there, and maybe I'll just see, and maybe there's this line doesn't go to infinity. So you build your telescope that's 10 times bigger, and you see out there, and you can see, oh, the numbers are still out there. The number line is still out there. So now I got to build a telescope 10 times bigger than that one. So you build that telescope and make it a lot bigger. And then you decide that, well, the Earth's atmosphere is getting in the way, so I'm going to build one. Let's just put one out in outer space. Then we don't have all this atmosphere to see through. And so then you put a lot of money, and maybe you would even call it the Hubble Space Telescope. And then it would look as far as it could see, and it's going to see a lot farther. It's going to see then a lot farther than any telescope that you could put down here on the surface of the Earth. Because of the clarity, you don't have the atmosphere. Because the highest mountain, even, the good mountains where they're putting telescopes, they're only 12,000 feet, something like that. Still a lot of atmosphere between them and outer space. So anyway, the point here is, can we measure an infinite universe? And the answer is no. So if up to the point you've built the best telescope you can build, if you look out and you still see things there that you couldn't see, that you could not see with your smaller telescope, then you have not hit the limit yet. You have not hit the limit. Okay, so when astronomers say they're looking to the edge of the universe, 13 billion light years away or something like that, because they measure distance in terms of time, basically, the time that it takes light to travel. So if you see something that's 13 billion light years away, that means that's the condition of whatever that thing is 13 billion years ago, because that's how long it took for the light to come to us. And so you can never know the current state of the universe by looking at it in visible light, because the light always takes a while to come to you. Okay, so anyway, so that's one way of trying to prove there's an infinite universe. But back to the point, if you can't see literally to the point where, okay, now we build a bigger telescope, and doggone it, you know, we don't see any new stars. We should be seeing a lot of new stars in galaxies and things like that, because we built a bigger telescope, but we're not. And then you could say, oh, well, you know, I think we hit the boundary. Beyond that point, there's nothing more out there. It's void. But maybe you just hit a big bubble, and looking out in that direction, and if you built a bigger telescope, 10 times bigger, all of a sudden you would leapfrog over that bubble and start to see more stars again. You don't know. There's no way of proving that there isn't more thing, or there is, by simply building a telescope. So if one claims that the universe is infinite in time, in the future and in the past, and in extent, how do you prove that? And so one suggestion was as follows. If the universe is infinite, then no matter where you look, there should be a star. And therefore, the whole sky should never be dark. There should be light coming at you all the time, from all directions, and because there's an infinite number of stars, not some big number, but literally an infinite number. And I want to. Here's what I want to do. I want to take that concept and show you that that concept is not true. So that's not a way to measure the size of the universe or whether you've seen to the edge of the universe. And it's very simple. I'm going to use another linear example, because in looking at the stars, what we're doing is looking at a three-dimensional example. And so the idea, and this is getting past the concept of infinity, in that there's some, what might be logical really is not. And I'm going to point something out. There's an entire branch of mathematics, and it deals with infinite series. Well, what is an infinite series? An infinite series is an equation that has an infinite number of terms in it. So you would think that if you added a number of infinite things together, it would certainly have to be infinite, correct? And the answer is no, not correct. If you add an infinite number of things together, like if you say, if you added 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and all the numbers, if you added them all together, if you added an infinite number of them together, you would get infinity. But if you added some finite number of those numbers together, you would never reach infinity. It might be some big number, but it wouldn't be infinity, and no matter how big your number is, that number, if you can write it out or think it, it's going to be small. I don't care what kind of number, zillion digits long. It's still small compared to infinity. Infinity is like, you know, unimaginably big. It's just like no matter how big a number you have, it's small compared to infinity. Okay, so why would you possibly have an infinite series of fractions? And this is where it gets mathematically kind of subtle. And it took mathematicians a long time to actually understand this. So let's take a series like, I'll take it actually a famous one that converges. In other words, if you add up this entire list of numbers, then, and they're fractions, then they add up to, they converge. In other words, they come up to a finite quantity. And it's, this particular one is called the Leibniz formula for pi, named after Gottfried Leibniz. And this is back in the old 1600s. So this apparently was published in about the latter part of the 1600s, just to give you an idea of how far back this thought on mathematics goes. But here's an infinite series that you add together, and it equals the number pi, the 3.1416, etc. And that number pi divided by 4, which is very interesting. And so that would be the equivalent of a 45-degree angle if you were dealing with circle geometry. But here's the series, and so you might want to write this down if you have a piece of paper, or just think about it. You start out with the number 1, and then you subtract 1/3. Okay, so it just starts 1 minus 1/3. Now you add a fifth, and so 1/5 is smaller than 1/3. Okay, so you're not adding very much back onto this. Then you subtract off 1/7, you add 1/9, and this series continues. So let me just say this quickly. 1 minus 1/3 plus 1/5 minus 1/7 plus 1/9. And you can see that it's 1 over 1 over. And the series goes 1 over 3, 1 over 5, 1 over 7, 1 over 9. But what's going on here is you subtract like 1/3, and then you add back 1/5. And then you subtract 1/7 and you add back 1/9. So it would seem that if you take these pairwise, the minus 1/3 plus 1/5, and then if you took the 1/7 negative 1/7 plus 1/9, that's going to leave you with a residual negative number. And so isn't it interesting that you end up with a number that's pi over 4, which is a little bit less than 1? And so now if you took the 1 out of there, you would have a number about the size of, about 3, let's just say, more or less. But this is the point being made here is that you can have an infinite number of fractions. And you would think, well, gee, even if they're little teeny, teeny numbers and you add an infinite number, you're going to have to get up to infinity. And the answer is no. And this is called a convergent series in mathematics. So now let's look at the design and three dimensions of the stars and the galaxies, etc. Now, if you take a given star up in the sky and you look at it, it's going to be a certain distance away. So that star is going to be very small. It's like the size of a pinhead, but in reality much smaller. And so now let's take the size of that star and we'll fill up a little space there up on our three-dimensional globe that surrounds the Earth. And so there light is coming from that particular location in the heavens. And all around it, it seems to be dark, because when you go out at night after dark, you see stars, you see little points of light up there. And that's because your eyes are not sensitive enough to see all the stars in between there. So that's why you build a bigger telescope, more light gathering power, and then all of a sudden, magically, you start seeing more stars. And so the point is, that it turns out that if the stars are small enough and far enough away, then you would not have complete coverage of the entire sky with light. Because if that were the case, then at night there would be no darkness ever. Even though you had a sun over here on this side, that would make the Earth brighter on that side, but it would never be dark. It'd be like this big dome of everything around you, the firmament, as they might say in the ancient vernacular, that means the heavens, everything you can see above you, that would mean that would be completely lit, but it's not. And so the point is that you can show mathematically that even if we live in an infinite universe, there's no way to prove that by simply imagining that all of the sky should be full of light because of the stars and galaxies and quasars and everything else out there. It doesn't work out that way. And it's for the same reason as the linear, the single-dimensional infinite series converge. They converge to give you a finite number, and that's equivalent of looking up in the sky and finding a finite number of stars, a finite portion of the heaven covered with stars, and big spaces in between the stars. And so there's a way of solving this, and you could actually have a limit of the distance to stars and the size of stars, the angular size of stars, and put it in and say, well, what if we had this many stars that were this close to us in the universe? And that would give you a measure of the scenario, the situation, the physical situation that would produce light in around the entire night sky. And it turns out that it's far short of the number of stars, etc., and the distance of stars that actually exist. Anyway, I was thinking about this particular problem the other day, and I thought it would be very good and instructive to talk about this, because all of these things can be understood by mathematics, but you look again back, it was Leibniz in the 1600s that was putting together the mathematics around these topics. I mean, just imagine the United States had not even formed yet. In fact, there were just a few colonies in the New World. There was trading going on. There was trading going on between Spain and England and France and other seafaring nations. They were trading with the New World, I guess trading isn't quite the right word. It's called ripping them off for all their resources. But just imagine the state of the world. And there were mathematicians that were so adept that they could figure out this issue of infinity. There was a mathematician, his name was George Cantor, C-A-N-T-O-R, Cantor. And one of my math classes in college was on the book by George Cantor, which was on infinities. And so George Cantor, this is another kind of a mind twister. One person might say, well, infinity is infinity. That's just as big as you can get. There isn't anything bigger, right? Well, there were some problems coming along in mathematics. And imagine that you take all the counting numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and you go all the way out to infinity. That's an infinity of numbers. But what if you had two numbers between every integer? So in a different set of numbers. So you'd have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But then between those, you would have, let's say, 1 1/3 and 1 2/3. You'd have two numbers between 1 and 2. And then you'd have two numbers between 2 and 3, 2 1/3, 2 2/3. Okay, and then between 3 and 4, you would have two numbers, 3 1/3 and 3 2/3. So it's just a simple example. And so now take that entire set of numbers. So instead of 1 2 3 4 5, you would have 1 1/3, 1 1/3, 1 2/3, 2, 2 1/3, 2 2/3, 3, 3 1/3, 3 2/3, 4, and like that. And so now you have, what do you have? Instead of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you have two more numbers that are in this set than before. So is your infinity now, if you count all these numbers, is your infinity 3 times what it used to be? How can you have 3 times infinity? Well, it would seem to be logical that the infinity of numbers in the second case was more than the infinity of numbers in the first case. But let's take and stretch your brain a little bit farther. Take all the rational numbers between 1 and 2. There are an infinite number of them. Rational numbers are the fractions. In other words, take an integer, 2/3 is a rational number. 4/5 is a rational number. And those numbers would be between 0 and 1. And so between 0 and 1, between 1 and 2, between 2 and 3, there's an infinite number of rational numbers. And so before, when we counted 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, now you have an infinite number between each one of those. So if you add up all of those infinities of all the rational numbers, is that a bigger infinity than the infinity of integer numbers? Well, it turns out that it is. So this is what George Cantor did. He kind of came in and he attacked this one problem in mathematics of infinities. It would be, for example, you go back to the old example of a fly on the back, or some little bug on the back of a flea, and that little flea is on the back of a dog, and that dog is on the earth, and the earth is, you know, and you go through this series of dimensional changes or orders of magnitude in size, and it's a way of understanding looking out into the universe in the other direction. What if our entire universe was just a microcell atom on the back of a flea on a dog someplace? So you get into all of these almost philosophical questions, but when you study mathematics, you have to understand all of these questions. So when we look out into the universe and you see all of the stars, of which there are many, 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 the question is, once again, if there's an infinite universe we live in, and there's an infinite number of stars, therefore, an infinite number of galaxies, then it should cover the entire night sky with light. And the answer is no, it shouldn't. It's not necessarily true. And if you could calculate the spatial resolution of all of the stars, etc., if you could bring them all closer, this is another way of doing this, kind of a what they call in Germany a Gedanken experiment or thought experiment. Take all the stars, go out as far as you want, and take all the stars and push them, bring them much closer, and now you're going to start to fill up all of the space around our visibility, our firmament, the visibility of the sky. You're going to completely fill that with stars. And the question is, how far in do you have to bring the star systems that we can see through a telescope? We know they're out there. How far do you have to bring them in before you would completely saturate the entire night sky with stars and even the entire daytime sky? That's another mathematical method, kind of a thought experiment on how to understand this. And now let them go back out to where they were. All the stars in the galaxies move back out to where they were. And that is beyond the limit where you would cover the entire sky, the entire firmament from our point of view, with light from stars, etc. There's a number of ways of looking at this, and what I'm going to try and do from now on in my shows is give people an understanding of some of these finer points and hopefully encourage young people to go into mathematics and physical science and physics, for example, very necessary. I'll just make a side comment here. This past week, I'm working quite some time. I've been working with a friend who's writing a book. He's an intellectual that I've known for many years. Never met him personally, but just through correspondence, etc. But he's writing a very good book. And so he's sending me parts of the book to proofread and comment. It turns out the book is on aspects of geology and the history of geology and history of thoughts relative to geology. the study of the Earth and the planets, etc. And as it turns out, I've analyzed these things myself in the past relative to geology, and I'll just give you an example, plate tectonics. The idea that these plates move around planet Earth freely and, you know, they collide and one goes under the other. It turns out that there's really no physics basis for what they're talking about. And you think, well, gee, it's in all the textbook. That's what they taught us. You know, it sounds good. And that's the answer. Yeah, it looks very good in a textbook. Looks very convincing. But if you apply physics to the problem, it's not possible at all. There's no way for plates that are on the surface of the Earth to move around sideways by themselves or by any force that is generated in the Earth. And you think, well, a subduction, one plate slides under the other, what's wrong with that? Well, the problem is it's called friction. If you take a mouse, like for your computer, you know, just you push that along the table, not too hard. Take and change your mouse to a 2,000-pound piece of granite rock sitting on your desk. Now try and push that around. That's teeny compared to the plate that sits on planet Earth. So where does the force come from to push this entire continental plate around the globe? Well, it isn't. There isn't any. It's absurd. But geologists repeat this. And what got them going onto this concept of plates moving around the Earth? Well, you can see plates sliding against one another and moving a little bit. There's one out just west of the city of Denver where the plates are just slightly moving, and you can see the ridges, etc., juxtaposition a little bit. And you think, well, isn't that proof? Well, no. What's actually happening there is that the boundaries are sliding because they're just sliding to get back to normal, because thousands of years ago on planet Earth, there was a major celestial object that came through the solar system and wrenched Earth's crust tremendously, and that's what happened. So the plates are still adjusting and getting back to normal, and that's what they're actually seeing. But as far as the Earth just doing this by itself one day, and that somehow the Earth formed 4.5 billion years ago and never had any outside influence, and all of a sudden these plates are just moving around the globe like willy-nilly, and like they say, oh, the America and African plates looked like they were one piece at one time, so we'll just theorize that through slow movement they moved away from each other. You know, looks good in a textbook. Looks good in some artist's conception, maybe in a video, but the reality is, ain't going to happen. Where do the forces come from? So then you go back to the geologists, and you say, geologists, where does the force come to make these plates move around? They can't answer it, because there isn't an answer. There is no answer because it doesn't happen. But hundreds of years, yeah, probably a good 100 or more years now, of plate tectonics have been taught all the way through the university level. Students have passed tests, gotten A's on tests by talking about plate tectonics. The end result? There's no way it could possibly exist. Where are the forces? And so I defined an experiment, and I said, let's make some hydraulic rams. Major, you know, a mile in diameter. These are big hydraulic rams, and on both sides of the hydraulic ram, you put a giant bulldozer blade, both sides, and you line these up all the way along, right along the continental boundary, pushing on one continental plate on one side and pushing on the other continental plate on the other side. You push the button, and all these hydraulic rams start moving and pushing, and your goal is to push the continental plate. And you say, well, they weren't big enough. Well, build some bigger ones. This is a Gedanken experiment. You can build these hydraulic rams big enough to move the whole continent. And so you're okay, we're going to really build some big ones. So you build these really, really, really big hydraulic rams and put the really, really big bulldozer blades on them, and you start, you turn on the switch and they start pushing apart, and you're going to push this continental plate away from that other one. Do you know what's going to happen? It's going to compress the local environment. It's going to compress the crust and this mantle of Earth locally, and it's going to cause a lot of distortion there. But it's not going to create a mountain range 2,000 miles away inland. That's ridiculous. Because, and so that's the point is that I don't care what kind of energy system or vertical heat system or volcanism you try and propose, there's nothing to make the plates move sideways around the globe. There's only one thing that can do that, and that's a very large celestial object passing by, putting a gravity wave into the surface of the Earth. That gravity is just like the tidal bulge on Earth, and as it sweeps around the Earth, that wave basically hits an obstruction, and all of that energy is absorbed, and that's how the mountains are formed. And these are big. We're talking about a 1,000-foot tidal wave in the landmass of the Earth. That's how big these were. Mass extinctions occurred at those times. And so anyway, the point is, the whole point here is that when you look at geologists or evolutionary biologists, or you look at space scientists, or you look at astronomers, the last physics course they took was maybe physics 101 or maybe 102 as freshmen in college. And then after that, they went off to finish their degree in astronomy or whatever and go off to school and become a professional astronomers. But they have no clue about the real world of physics. Can stuff happen? How about logic? There's in astronomy, for example, there's allegedly something called the Oort cloud. After Oort, he was like, I think, a Norwegian scientist. And he proposed that ice ball comets would come into the solar system. And they never quite had enough velocity to indicate that they came from infinity. But they came from someplace way out there. So he proposed this Oort cloud, you know, really distant from our sun. And that supposedly that's where all the ice ball comets come from. Well, it's a good proposal, maybe. Looks good in the textbook. It's in every college textbook in astronomy. I know, I used to teach astronomy in the university level. And when we got to a lot of these topics, I'd tell the students, this is baloney. You know, that, and they'd do, well, it's in the textbook. Yeah, but it's baloney. Because you can't prove it, you can't disprove it. That's not the way science is done. If you're going to propose some theory, you better have a way of demonstrating it through experimentation, through observation. And since the Oort cloud is so far away and these comets are so little, allegedly, that you can never see them, and if you sent a spacecraft, say we built the spacecraft and we sent it out there in 50 years, it finally got to one point in the Oort cloud, well, it couldn't see around the whole rest of the Oort cloud, this big disk supposedly that rings our entire sun. And so there's no way to prove this with any technology that we would ever be able to build and send out and or through telescopes or any other means. So the Oort cloud is an unprovable idea, yet it's in every textbook. And physically, it doesn't make any sense. The real reason comets come in from an alleged non-infinite position is because of the tail drag. As soon as they become comets, they meet resistance, and the tail drag, when they discharge the solar capacitor, that causes them to slow down a little bit. That's what they're seeing. So there's an observation that comets don't come from infinity, but what's really causing it? Is it because they're coming from the Oort cloud? That's one explanation. Is there a way to prove that? No. Is there a way to prove my concept that it's tail drag? Yeah, it is. It's been proven. You can see it. You can see it in comets. And Comet Hale-Bopp was a very good example. The bigger the comet, the bigger the deflection from its normal orbit, the bigger the perturbation, it's called. So at any rate, the point I'm getting back to my friend's book, my point is, was that when you look at sciences, their so-called hard science, geology, microbiology, say organic chemistry, I always talk about this, that organic chemistry is really strange because why is a carbon atom in an organic molecule acting different than a carbon atom in a non-organic molecule? Nobody can tell you that. That's a very valid question. What makes an organic molecule organic? That's the basis of your body. The human, the DNA and everything in your body is based on the same chemicals that might make up a rock. You know, the carbon, the hydrogen, the oxygen, the nitrogens, phosphates, the phosphorus, etc. Those are all things that you can find in a rock. So what makes your body so special that it functions the way it does and is made up of the same stuff you could find in a rock? They can't answer that question. So they just say, oh, well, that's because it's organic. Oh, really? That doesn't tell me anything. That means they don't know what they're talking about. There's no concept for why certain molecules act organic and other molecules act inorganic, although they're made up of the same atomic components. Anyway, so science today has some serious holes in it, and a lot of the problems come from the fact that, like I was saying, that geologists don't understand physics. The last physics course they took was, you know, rolling a ball down a plane, and, you know, maybe they got a B or a C in physics, and that's the last course they had in physics. So they don't know. They don't know what they don't know. They're clueless. So they teach this stuff. And then when you go to try and tell them, or astronomers, that what they're talking about, dirty snowball comet model, if, you know, here's a great example. Take the dirty snowball comet model, that once the comet develops, the coma itself blocks the solar light from reaching the comet nucleus. So how can the comet nucleus keep melting, or sublimating is the actual word, turning from solid to a gaseous state? And the answer is it doesn't work. I mean, just peel back the first layer, onion layer of the dirty snowball comet model. It doesn't work. But these people are not physicists. Carl Sagan was not a physicist. You know, made lots and lots of errors, physical errors in the theories he proposed, had no way to check them out, and a lot of times once they were checked with actual measurements, they turned out to be false, but they never retracted anything. So a good example there is, for example, Carl Sagan stated that Venus was a very old planet. This is back in the 1970s. Carl Sagan said that Venus was a very old planet because with radar images from the Arecibo telescope, the radio telescope, they bounced signals off of Venus, and it was very cratered. They could tell by the way the signals came back. So he said, therefore, the surface of Venus is very old, like our moon, and end of story. Venus must be very old. Problem with that is once they sent up the Magellan orbiter to orbit the planet Venus, and with radar mapping, because you couldn't see through the atmosphere, it turned out that what they were measuring in the craters, these were not impact craters like on the moon. These were volcanic craters, and they were so active they could see them erupting and changing shapes. By the time the Magellan orbiter came around for a second set of measurements, the planet had already changed. It was like plastic. It was like hot plastic, molten and bubbling. It looked like It looked like a surface would be like oatmeal bubbling in the morning in the hot pan on the stove. That's what the surface of Venus is like. But do you think anybody ever came back and retracted that? No. Nope. So bad science, once bad science is established and published, it sticks, kind of like something on a wall, throwing a lot of mud on the wall and it's stuck. Okay, so anyway, a few basic comments about science there. But in the mix, it turns out, I just want to say something, that Venus is a very young planet. It has all the characteristics of a young planet, and interestingly enough, it already has a massive atmosphere, which contains, in other chemicals, hydrogen and oxygen, which are the main components of water. So, eventually, when Venus cools down from its state of being a brand new planet, it will have oceans, it's all the chemicals necessary for what we find on Earth. Okay, just a quick mention here. Now, a couple weeks ago, I announced the space launch system, and I had it posted for a little bit on my webpage. I've taken that down because I'm concentrating on my wing generator, etc. That's what all of my work is going to right now, and I'll be talking about that in a minute here. But I described a launch system which was runway to space. In other words, you take off with a regular plane, airplane type of vehicle. You take off from a runway. You could do this from any airport on the planet. You take off. You go up to 50, 60,000 feet with the carrier vehicle. And then in the case of my design, it's basically a hollow tube. It's like a rocket launcher. And the reason I'm mentioning this, because about, I think it's back in the 50s, about 70 years ago now, there was a picture that I saw of Neil Armstrong, the first guy that NASA allegedly sent to the moon, but as a young pilot. So here he was a Navy flyboy, and flying the X-15 rocket plane. And that was probably the top assignment that you could give to someone back in the day. But the X-15 was a rocket plane, and they took it up under the wing of a B-52 bomber, you know, standard B-52 bomber. They take it up to about 50,000 feet, drop it off, and then they'd kick in the rocket engine, and it broke a record, this back in the 50s, of going up, actually going into space and then coming back. So it hit a record altitude of what they were saying, 375,000 feet. That's about 60 miles up in the air. And this was the real space program. Anyway, I thought it was very interesting to see that. Why they canceled that program, the X-15 program, I'll never know. That's what should have been going on. They should have never developed big rockets. And just along that same point, I saw a picture of a train, and it's hauling all of the sections of the Space Launch System. That's the name for SLS, for NASA's big rocket that they want to take people to the moon and Mars and all this other stuff, which ain't going to happen, by the way. Don't hold your breath. But it's a solid rocket booster that's used. So they're going to reuse this. And this was a series of steel cylinders that composed the outer shell of a solid rocket booster. But this had been used way back in the early days of the space program. And it was used also on the space shuttle Discovery. So anyway, I just find this amazing that they would be reusing these, especially after the disaster of the space shuttle and how that whole program ended in a not so nice manner. Why would they still be using a reusable solid fuel rocket booster that was the main failure from what they were showing? It was the main failure point on the shuttle, space shuttle disaster, where it blew up, where the what a with the teacher on board and all of that stuff. Wow. At any rate, runway to space is really the best way to go, and that will continue. That will continue to grow, especially in the private sector. There's a lawsuit going on today, right now, regarding fluoride in the water. And so I encourage you to keep an eye on that. There's actually, I believe, a number of cases going through and suing the government for allowing fluoride, sodium fluoride, to be placed in the water systems. And then just another quick mention here. I'm going to skip these topics because I want to get on to a little bit of self-promotion here. The wing generator, all of that is going very well. The grow towers, I've sold my, and I started selling these, a month and a half ago? It took me a long time to put this business together, but then I finally commercialized it and released it to the public about a month and a half ago, and I sold a lot of these to families, the individual smaller units, but I just completed a commercial sale, which is actually a foreign commercial sale, so very nice. So these are really hitting home with the public, and it really rounds out my particular product line with the energy, the water, and now food production on a very concentrated level. I'm very happy with this. I mean, it just jumped like out of the starting blocks, did very well. And then, of course, the shipping containers. With people who buy the wing generator, I can get used shipping containers, and that's helpful because the price is less. So when they receive their wing generator, etc., they will also have a very sturdy container for the electronics and other related things that go along with the wing generator. But I don't sell used to anybody else. It's not my business. It's only to have a good shipping container for the people who are buying the wing generator. And then, of course, my Patreon channel. You can go there. The link is on my webpage. And throw a little money my way. It comes in a monthly basis. That's something that helps a lot to help pay the bills and keep all of this operating. But go to my webpage. And my new book, by the way, is listed on the sales page down by the book. So I've incorporated that in just the general part of the sales page dealing with my books, CDs, DVDs, etc. So at any rate, I'm very happy with everything that's going on. I'm concentrating on what I do, the positive things, and trying to help the world as best I can from that vantage point. So once again, my webpage, jmccsci.com. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.